getting the handout that looks like this, from 3 Sundays ago, I'm on the very last word of that handout where it says gossip. And we're going to start with gossip today, which is a bit of a context. And then I gave you the rest of the handouts for the rest of chapter 1 in the packet I just handed you. We will be taking that all the way through into verse 32. Just by way of review, we are in the book of Romans. The book of Romans deals with... Book of Romans, as we've seen it, is outlined by a very lengthy introduction for Paul, 17 verses, verse 7. It's one long sentence where he lays out who he is and who he's writing to. Then we saw some personal details in verses 8 through 15. In verses 16 through 17, we saw his great thesis statement that he's not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God unto salvation, to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. For it is the righteousness of God that is revealed, for the just shall live by faith. And so we see this whole gospel, this whole book of Romans, if you will, is in the gospel of righteousness from God is being revealed. Because the righteous shall live by faith. And it's a great gospel talking about faith. But as he moves into that, he wants to first talk about what the problem is and why we need to have righteousness. So he talks about the sin condition in verses 118 through 320. And we are in the very, very first section of that where we see that Gentiles are guilty. We see that Gentiles are guilty. And we saw in verses 18 through 22 the reasons for that. And we looked at it this way. We said it causes God to get angry. We talked about 4 reasons why God got angry. In verse 18 was that he suppressed the truth. In verses 19 through 22, because the evidence that was known about God from creation, from their consciousness, had been denied. It had been ignored. And as a result, he wasn't honored. They were ungrateful people. In verse 21, and his glory was given away. The phrase that appeared there was it was exchanged. So we looked at 3 times it says they changed his glory in the passages we went up there in the verse sections leading from 18 through 23. And then we saw as a result of that, the results of Gentile guilt. God gives them over 3 times. That's like they exchanged his glory 3 times. Well, he gives them over 3 times. He gave them over, first of all, to a sinful desire of their hearts. Then he gave them over to shameful lust, where they violated their bodies in unnatural ways. And finally, he gave them over to a depraved mind. And we are in the midst of looking at this section of a depraved mind. When we saw, reading verses 28 through 32, is actually one sentence in the Greek. In our English, they have broken it up every time there is a change in the type of word that Paul is using. We saw that he started off with a dative, which is that wonderful Greek form of word that talks about how something relates because of what it is. And it starts up with, for since they did not think it worthwhile to retain knowledge of God, he gave them over to a depraved mind to do that which ought not to be done. They have become filled with every type of, in the dative, wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity. 4 things that characterize. Then he moves from the dative into the adjective case where he talks about things that are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. And that's where we stopped last week. Then he continues down here into what's referred to as the accusative case. And there are things he accuses them of being, things that they are. Things like gossipers, slanderers, God-haters, insolers, arrogators, boastfulers. Now, I know that's some of the text, but it actually has the ER on it. We were looking at the English sense in the Greek. So they put it back in there. They invent evil ways of doing it. They're disobedient to parents. And then finally, we see 4 things where they are without. Things that are causing them to be senseless, without sense, without faith, without heart. They are without mercy. They are ruthless, if you will. Although they knew God's righteous decrees that those who do such things deserve death, they continue to do these very things. Not only do they do them, but they actually encourage or they approve come and join them. And so we put up our outline. We've been following through this pattern that says, God therefore abandoned them, not only to a depraved mind, but ultimately to unrighteousness. He says, you don't want my righteousness. You want to suppress my righteousness. You don't want to glorify my righteousness. You don't want to have anything to be grateful for my righteousness. You want nothing to do with me. You keep exchanging it. Fine. I will give you over to a dishonored body, to dishonored passions that are natural, and that which is unrighteous. And so as we pick up our study this morning, we are sitting here in this one very long Greek sentence. We're just going to continue in our text. We move, as I mentioned to you, from the genitive case, which is described and defined other nouns and pronouns, and more like an adjective describing they are. He now moves into the accusative case, which indicates the direct object, the things that they are becoming, the things they are like. And there are 12 words that appear that way. We look here. First one we see is that they are become gossips in the NIV text. Gossipers is a literal translation of the term. It's a common noun, but it's in the accusative case, which puts a sort of ER on the end of the word, if you will. It's a very old Greek word, and it means to speak into the ear, to speak secretly. It has this idea of whispering. In fact, if you have the old English versions, you say they are whisperers. Because people gossip and they whisper about it. And it's this whole idea. You'll notice that the New English version says they are secret slanderers. The whole idea, this is stuff that's done quietly, behind the scenes. The New Living Testament says they're gossips. But the context we see here that goes on to us, this word includes those who are secretly, in a sly manner, with a hint of innuendo, if you will. They distract, they excite suspicion. The English word that might fit well here is a very old English word. We don't see it very much today, but rumor mongers. You know, that type of idea, they fit well here. It does not mean those who openly cause trouble, but this is relatively those that just give hints of trouble because of the way they say things in quiet, silent ways. And they have great knowledge, but they take that great knowledge to communicate an evil report and add it to the secrecy of what they're saying. So people begin to believe it because it's said in the way it's being divulged. This class of people abounds everywhere. I think we all have been done by innuendo. They are scarcely anyone more dangerous to the peace and happiness in society when things are said behind your back and no one even knows what's going on. That's the context that says these people with a depraved mind move into. And the next one it says to them, it says they are slanderers. Now, this is a very interesting Greek word, and it's found nowhere else in the Bible at all except here. In fact, we've only found it one other time in Greek literature. And it's actually used in what's referred to as the Shepherd of Hermas, which was a very apocryphal writing in the 2nd century AD. It almost became part of canon. They almost opened up the canon and put it back in when you read church history. It's cited by Irenaeus and Tyrillian as part of what they believe should have been scripture. They tried to justify it, but the church at large never really accepted it as part of it. But it's a word, it's a compound word. It's also here in the accusative case, it's in the plural. Kata is the word against something. Leto, speaking, I speak. So it's against speaking, or speak maliciously, to slander, to false accuse. We can see the various texts, as I told you, the Greek words. One of the things we're doing here is looking at 12 translations, just seeing if we could gain a lot of what we understand by understanding Greek, just by looking at the English that is used. And we see words like slanderers, backbiters, backstabbers, evil speakers. The context here, these are things that are done in public. Unlike the gossipers that's done behind the scenes, this is one that is done where gossipers declare secretly with great reserve their proposed faults in others. Slanderers proclaim them publicly, and they go out of their way to make sure everybody knows about this. This is a very public proclamation, if you will, of what is going on here. So we have both the behind the scenes and, if you will, in the forefront, Both things are being characteristics of these people that have depraved minds. The third thing we see, they are God haters. Literally, it's the word theos. We see the word God here. This is the adjective form, adjective to hate. It's also the accusative. It's plural. Literally, if you were to translate it, it's God hated, which has caused some trouble with understanding what this word means. It's a very old word. As I mentioned to you, it literally means hated of God. And so, are they the ones who hate God, or are they the ones who are hated by God? And both things are probably true, but which one is Paul saying here? And many of the commentaries will spend excessive numbers of pages trying to defend their view. And probably half of them come out and say it's the passive view of this word. That is, it's a Greek word in its original context, meant God hates you. You're hated of God. You're God-hated, if you will, in a literal interpretation of the text. It's the way in all the ancient Greek texts, when you ran across this, when it talked about Apollo hating you. Or this is a word that was used. It was always the God hating the person. And it was not used about them, the person hating God. On the ancient examples, we see in the passive tense. And here it is in the passive as well. And so there's a lot of things from just Greek literature to believe those are hated of God. It's the same phrase that Paul uses over in Titus in the third chapter in the third verse. He says, we live in malice and envy, being hated and hating one another. Being hated, that first phrase there, being hated by other people, is that the same word here without the word theos in front of it. The same ending of the word. And so it's there. Thus, if it's in the passive, it would mean to be a horde of God, to be detestable because of the character. It's the verses that we find in the Old Testament. It says, the mouth of an adulteress is in a deep pit. He who is under the Lord's wrath will fall into it. This whole idea of being under the wrath of God. And since this passage is talking about the wrath of God being revealed back in 118, a lot of the commentators felt very strongly that this is God hated, or hated of God. Psalm 73:20 says, as a dream when one awakes, so when one arises, Lord, you will despise them as fantasies. This idea that God despises and God hates this behavior. Now, in favor of the alternate view, reading this as an act of something they're doing, they hate God. They rebel against God. They are deceivers by their own providence. They are the ones who suppress the truth. They are the ones who did not give honor. They're the ones who were ungrateful. And all the things have been active up until this time. And so those who read that part of the commentary passage say, no, no, no. This is talking about those that are hating God because of their very nature. They have become so depraved in their mind, they don't just have peaceful coexistence. They are actively, belligerent, attacking who God is. Modern-day synonyms might be things like condemners of sacred things, maligners of providence, scorners of God, devout atheist. This active view aligns very well with the finishing part of a diabolic character. And therefore, in the text, as you're moving through it, says, these are people that actually hate God because of their very nature. No more severe charge can be brought against mankind than that they are haters of God. It's the highest possible crime. Yet it's a charge that the conduct of men freely pick up. In fact, they condone others to come join them, if that's what it's telling them. To awaken the sinner's heart here is to try to help them see there's a God. They say, I hate you for trying to tell me there's a God. I want no part of God. I want nothing to do with him. I don't want to hear from you. I don't care what you're telling me. It betrays an ultimate pit of despair. And many of the commentators felt that was a better view of this word. Those who like to teach that go to passages like here we see an act of hatred of God over in John 7:7. This is, the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify to what it does. He who speaks of his own does so to gain honor for himself. But he who works for the honor of the one who sent him is a man of truth. There's nothing false about him. So it says, if you're not
following after Jesus, you are false. You are a hater of God. They look at the passages when it goes on, where Jesus is speaking to those Pharisees. Stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. At this point, some of the people of Jerusalem began saying, isn't this the man they're trying to kill? You see, they hate God. They're actively pursuing the hate. John puts this, and we'll come back at the end and look at it again. This is the verdict, that light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light, because their deeds are evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. You see the idea? They actively hate God as opposed to God hating them. Because it's not God's character to say, I don't like you, I hate you, I despise you, I don't want anything to do. Because God gave them over for the purpose of redeeming them, of buying them back. And so I think personally, while the word from a Greek standpoint fits best in the passive, I just can't see God condemning and hating people. So I don't care for you. I don't want anything to you. Jesus didn't die for you. I hate you type of mentality. But rather, they're haters of God. So I tend to, because of my theology, read this as God haters. Just the way the NIV wrote it. But I will tell you that the purists in the language have on their side the formation of the word and its usage in the passive. But I think the theology of the passage feels better in this wrong. But it probably means both. It can be interpreted either way. And Paul may have been ambiguous because he wanted to have both connotations understood. Yes,
Lavelle. Well, I think the way I think about it is God loved us. First, he loved us. But he hates sin.
Yes. Right.
Right.
I believe that I hear you. My typical response is God hates the sin, but he loves the sinner.
That's true. I'm sorry.
And therefore, it's the sin he hates. But this is not talking about the sin. This is talking about the view that he is, or whatever this characteristics is. Whatever this characteristics is, it's a characteristic of one who is hateful towards God or who is accusing God.
And
the context comes down to, surely this is the native characteristic. It just truly is, they hate God. This shows how far they have fallen and how much God still loves them in spite of, because it's one thing to love those who love you, but God loves those that hate him. And he continues to reach out. Yes, Dale.
I think in a modern context, certainly years ago, culturally, we would never accepted the people for the separation of, you know, the people who stand up at Christmas and say vile and mean and hateful things, and now it's more and more just commonplace that they show it very definitely that they hate God. They hate any mention of his name.
I sense that. And maybe it's my modern bias by what I'm seeing, but I sense that. Yes, sir. I love the context that way. I think that's why the NIV and most of the modern translations translate it God, haters of God, or God hater, as opposed to God hating them. But you'll notice that your older translations do translate it hateful to God. Because it is a literal relating of what the Greek says, but it may be because we don't understand it, but I agree with you, sir, that the text is talking about people and the characteristics they are. And so the NIV provided some interpretation, much like the New American Standard did, the King James, and other. They all interpreted it to be people who hate God, as opposed to people that God hates. I just want you to point out that when we read, sometimes people have already done some interpretive work for us when they moved it from Greek into English. That's another reason why you might want to read multiple English translations, because you get to see if there is a interpretation being applied to you that may not be there, or is there an alternate understanding that may also be true? And by looking across, in this case, we're looking at 12 translations. But as I mentioned to you, I believe if you looked at five, you could get 90% of what you're going to get from reading the Greek. So you don't have to be a Greek scholar. You have to own five English translations. And you don't have to own them. You have to own a computer, and there's hundreds of them on the internet. And just go forth and do it. Anyway, moving on to our next word in this sense. It says the word insolent. Now, that's a word that's used by the NIV, the New American Standard, the New English Translation, the English Standard Version, the New Revised Standard Version, the American Standard Version, the World English Bible, the New Living Testament, and the World English Bible. So you can see, this is a word that a lot of people sort of align on. That's a good modern word for it. You'll notice the Old English uses the word despiteful. The New King James, when it tried to update it, says that's a word people aren't going to understand, despiteful. They chose the word violent. By the way, the New American Standard and the NIV both translate the same word, hubris, as violent, same way that the New King James translated it here in 1 Timothy 1:3, the other place, 1:13, the only other place it appears in the scriptures. And so it's not like, why do they choose insolent here and violent? You'd have to ask the translators why they did that. But these are things, if you had a concordance that shows you everywhere that Greek word is used, like a Strong's concordance, you could look at that type of pattern. But insolent, if you were looking for it, in the Greek, it's this word here. It means one who behaves humiliating, unconscionable, arrogance to those who are powerful enough to retaliate. So right. Not powerful enough to retaliate. So says F.F. Bruce.
Hubris.
Well, I have the way he wrote it. I quoted him. And this is where you'll find out. There is no Y in Greek, or there are no U in Greek. It's the same letter. In some English translations, put a U and some put a Y. There's only 24 letters there. There's no J either. Basically, the J and the Y often get played with Jehovah and Yahweh. Same type of thing when it moves out. Different people translate them different ways. The text that I'm using spells it this way. The text that F.F. Bruce is using spells it this way. It's just a coincidence, if you will, or problems when you transliterate words. Do you stay in their alphabet, or do you stay in the English alphabet? Most people pronounce the word better. But the word denotes those who abuse or treat with unkindness or disdain those who are present. They joy seeing in their presence, making them feel low. And this is what the scriptures describe these people. If that's not enough, he says they're arrogant. This is a word that you will see. Well, look, we left that open parenthesis. This is a word you will notice. It gets translated arrogant in the three modern translations. Some of the more newer translations, since those came out, as well as some of the older ones, went back to the phrase haughty. The idea is this idea of being proud. It comes from huber, which means above and over, and this word here, which means I show or I shine. So to shine or show above and beyond what you should. The word denotes a feeling of personal superiority, one that causes one to look down with contempt on others. Webster defines pride as an inordinate self-esteem, an unreasonable amount of self-conceit, one's superiority in talents, beauty, wealth, accomplishments. The arrogant and prideful continually exalt themselves and try to depress others. They magnify themselves at the expense of others and wish that all men would see them, particularly among the Greek philosophers, as the great oracles, people you would come to hear them make pronunciations or their sayings. It's a particularly striking among the ancients. And when Paul writes to these Romans, to these Greeks, this is something that they all looked for. They wanted to be the oracle of the day. The sect of the Stoics were particularly noted in being distinguished about this characteristics of being boastful and proud about what they did. Men will be proud that they were supposed that none are more superior than them, to include God, because they're more superior than God because they've rejected God for who God is. And their rebellion reveals how great and infinite God is when you consider how finite they are. But God has given them to a depraved mind. And in this mindset, a mindset that teaches that all is blessed and that they are the most blessed of everybody. And people look at me and say, you're blessed? Heck, I don't want to be blessed if you're blessed. But people have this false view of themselves. And God gives them over to this sustained station where they occupy not humility, where God says, be humble and I will lift you up. But they are boastfully proud. We may add that this system of hedonism did not disclose the wickedness of the heart. And it's the main reason we see self-esteem being so prevalent among them, because they thought it was the way to get out of their wickedness was to become even more so that people would like them better. Yet it drives in the opposite situation. But Noah, the arrogant, uses this other phrase that they are boastful. Now, actually, if you start looking at these words, you'll notice they start rhyming. Hebrus, I don't read Greek very well, I'm sorry. I read it, but I don't pronounce it well, anything.
Arizona.
But it's what I've been told, it is a rhyming phrase. Those three phrases just fall off in rapid succession from one another. So Paul is going through here. He says they are boastful. Now this is a word almost every modern translation agrees is the best English word to describe it. The more literal translation of Darby and Young say boasters, because it's literally got the ER on the end of it. But we don't tend to speak that way as boasters. We talk about being boastful. And so we tend to use the adjective form. But in words, it means to be boasting or pretentious, arrogant, self-coming. It comes from a word that means to wander around. We get our English phrase to be a vagabond. It comes out of the root as that word begins to migrate. Hence, an imposter or somebody who tries to boast who they are, so you won't really know who they really are behind the scene. This word you see here with the ah in front of it, the base word means to assume. So it means to be not assuming, or to be pretentious, to be extra, to be self-assuming, vainglorious, arrogant. But those words have already been used in some of the previous ones. So the English translations use the word boastful here. But the context it's trying to get out here, we see things that are all three are tightly wound on this by this word called pride. And Paul is describing them here as a person who is inordinately self-conceitful, who will be slow to proclaim the merits of others because he's so busy proclaiming his own. The term denotes those who seek admiration for others with false claims about things they've never done. Richard Trench put it this way in his work on the synonyms of the New Testament. He says, insolent focuses on activities, arrogant on their thoughts, and boastful on their words. I sort of like that, so I put it there for you to consider as you start looking through them. But not only are these people characterized by these types of actions, but it goes on. They invent ways of doing evil. Well, this is the first time we have, up until this point, we've always had a single word in the text. If you notice, it's been up there. Been one Greek word after another. Here, it's actually two words that appear. We have the word that appears first here. It's a common noun for an accuser. It just means simply inventor. And we find this other word we've already seen previously in the text, but evil. So this is invents evil, if we were to literally translate it. The NIV puts it, they invent ways of doing evil. The New American Standard just says inventors of evil. Pretty straightforward. Some of the older translations will read inventors of evil things. Contrivers is what the translation I'm falling more and more enjoying as it's starting to come out as the New English Translation. Contrivers of all sorts of evil. Kenneth Taylor in his revised, and he updated his living paraphrase in his living translation, says they are forever inventing new ways of sinning. See what the idea is? I find it intriguing that mankind has spurned the Creator. They want nothing to do with him, but they want to become creative. So they're going to create evil. I just find, what irony when they become depraved in their own mind. As sin's self-perpetuating momentum carries on, fallen humanity demonstrates a deadly creativity, a practicing unrighteousness. Julia, put a handout right there for you. This phrase doubtless refers to mankind seeing or seeking to find the new art, new ways of practicing evil, new devices to gratify the lust of their passion, because they've already practiced unnatural things, and eventually that wears out. So they got to find new ways of being even more depraved, because they can't satisfy the lust that they're seeking afterwards. So they invent all kinds of ways of practicing evil to gratify their passions, to be inventors of a new form of vice. Nero was a great example. He said he invented new pleasures. He found new ways of hunting by taking his soldiers and putting them out and killing the soldiers first so he could step through their blood as he went after the animal. So he developed a bloodthirst. He thought this was a clever way of hunting, to slaughter people in the path. In cities of luxury and vice, it's interesting when you study those places how this becomes a common characteristic of evil. They find new ways to try to practice the evil. Vices changes the form of men. They can't be satiated. They can't be satisfied. So they become obliged to try to find or to resort to inventing new ways of being perverse. The passion ceases to gratify as they practice it. And so they go and invent new ones. And this becomes characteristics of them. Now this was very true of ancient Rome. A place of the art of luxury, the devices of passion. The splendor of gratitude. We looked at murder last week, about everything that took place in the Colosseum with the gladiators and the types of wars. But it gets even more perverse when you begin to look at other things they did in their homes and in their societies. By the way, unless we pick on the Romans, this is not unique to Romans. This is not just a Roman problem. It's a mankind problem. Multitude of evil things, destructive abominations, and ceremonies have come out of all kinds of heathen nations. You might remember when we studied back in the Judges, the Canaanites liked human sacrifice. They thought it was a neat way to draw themselves nearer to their gods. And we talked about the various societies across the planet. This is not a Western thing. This is a man who's in sin thing. People, you look at the killing fields that went on in Cambodia. You look across. I'm not trying to pick on any one nation. I'm just trying to look at men. They're sinful. This is what becomes of them. The Aztecs here among the Central American Indian tribes. You look at the Incas in Southern and Latin America. Same thing is found. I don't know much about our Chinese heritage, but I'm sure it's true in China as well. As you look for these things, many a places. But if this wasn't enough, they're not only inventors or anything, but they become interesting. This phrase picks up disobedient to parents, literally. Disobeyed parent. I think I got it right there.
So.
Yes.
It sort of falls in line if you don't respect God, then the rest of them fall right in line.
That's right.
Including with disobeying.
Right, because if you will, parents is a descendant that God created a social order. And God said you should have parents and you should be obedient to them. It's the first commandment with a promise. But if I hate God, I'm going to hate his promises. I'm going to hate all of his commands and deal with them. And he's going to zap them. And so they come out there. So it's not unusual that you see it, but it surprises people when they say, well, hold it. I'm mad at my mom and dad, but I'm certainly not those other things. Yeah, you are. You're probably there. You'll notice the NIV translates it simply, they disobey their parents. Disobedient to parents is a literal translation. Rebellious is the way the connotation that the New Revised Standard put out there. 1 Timothy 1:9 puts it this way. We also know that law is made not for the righteous, but for lawbreakers and rebels, the ungodly and sinful, the unholy, irreligious, for those who kill their fathers and mothers. Now,
that phrase you got translated to kill is the same word here.
So it brings with the connotation of not just mamby-pamby, I don't pay attention to my parents, but actually killing parents, murdering parents, either because of your words, and maybe sometimes literally because of your actions that transpires here. You'll notice in 2 Timothy, when Pastor started this passage on the last days, he went to this passage and he said, but mark this, there will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents. We talked about these lists. This list happens to be 21 things in it. It's the longest list of vices, but none of them are complete. You can look at them and you'll find some in one list that aren't in the other. They're not trying to say this is an exhaustive list. But it's interesting that disobedient to parents shows up in most of the list as you move through them. It's this whole connotation. At the center of human society is marriage and the family. And when God is under attack, you find it surprise that the family is under attack? You find it surprise that marriage is under attack? The things that represent the things that are going on here?
Again, as we come back here, goodness is a common noun. It's a data case. It's masculine, plural. It means parents. And it's parent haters. Had it reversed. I'm sorry. The adjective that it modifies it is an accusative case. You'll notice again this little odd that's out there in front of the order we talked about it. It's a dual word. It means not obedient or disobedient.
These two Greek words express the idea that they have, those who have depraved minds do not show to their parents the honor, the respect, and attention that is due. They did not believe in, respect, or support those who gave birth to them and raised them into adulthood. Now, this was a crime in ancient Rome. And it's interesting. It's a crime in most pagan societies, but it's never enforced. The rules say you will take care of the elderly. But we don't. We ignore them. We move aside. The duty of honoring parents was a Roman law. And yet the Romans were most notorious for taking their parents out and slaughtering them so they don't have to take care of them. And so when Paul writes to them here, he's pointing out they're in violation even of their own law, their own goodness adhere. James Kent, in his commentary, put it this way. Disobedient to parents was punished by the Jewish law with death and by the Hindus in their attended with their laws of a child's inheritance. The ancient Greeks considered the neglect to be extremely impious and attended the most certain effects of divine vengeance. Solon, remember, he's the king of Athens, or the ruler of the city-state of Athens, ordered that all persons who refused to make due provision for their parents to be punished with infamy. And the same penalty was to be incurred by personal violence towards them. And yet, we see society that's are disobedient to parents. They have norms, but they pay no attention to them. If you will, they become people that are haters. The pride of feeling of their haughtiness leads not only to them beefing themselves up, but if they're going to be lifted high, they've got to put their parents down because they don't want anybody getting in the way of them getting to the top. It might be felt that they might have provided me a birth vehicle, but it was only the vehicle. I dispose of the vehicle. When I finish, I get a new one. And I move on in life. It has been one characteristic of heathens everywhere that when they begin to mistreat their parents, you know what the next happens? They mistreat their children. And child abuse follows in society. Among the Sandwich Islanders, it was customary that when a parent becomes too old, infirm, or sick, beyond the hope of recovery, it was the child's duty to bury their child, to bury their parents alive. American Indians did the same thing. It was their duty to not kill them. It was wrong. Just bury them alive. This shows you the side thing. In fact, it's a common custom in India for children to leave their aged parents by the bank of the Ganges. You just take them out there and drop them. Bye. You know, the bottom line, those who are disobedient to parents are the bitter fruit of a culture that is spurring the will and the way of God. This is what we're seeing that's going on here. Like greed, disobeying parents is rebellion against the creative order. We were meant to be there. Just to give you some background, the Bible speaks very strongly with admonitions to honor parents. It starts off with Exodus 20, verse 12, right in the middle of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. It says, honor your mother and your father, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God has given you. Exodus 21. Anyone who attacks his father or mother must be put to death. Exodus 21, 17. Anyone who curses his father or mother must be put to death. Leviticus 19. Each of you must respect his mother and father, and you must observe my Sabbath. Right there. Worship of God and honoring your parents. Parallel in the Jewish mindset. Proverbs 17, 6. Children's children are crowned to the aged, and parents are the pride of the children. Listen to your father who gave you life. Do not despise your mother when she is old.
When I was on the staff with Campus Crusade, I can remember little Rusty was a three-year-old running around. We were memorizing scriptures. And little Rusty runs up to me and says, "Children, obey the Lord, for this is right." And he would run all over the neighborhood, telling everybody sitting there in the sandbox, "Children, obey your parents, for this is right." And he was having a grand time making a mess. And this verse, every time I see it, I think of Rusty. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and your mother, which is the first commandment, with a promise that your days may be long upon the earth. Colossians, Paul writes to them, he says, children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. But you know, the scriptures just don't speak about honoring parents. They give strong warnings against those who don't honor their parents. Some of the ones we looked at earlier, it says they should be put to death. You look over in the Deuteronomy section, it says, "Your honor your father and your mother as the Lord your God has commanded you, so you may live upon the earth, that you go wealthy in the land the Lord has given you. And a man, a stubborn and rebellious son who does not obey his father and mother, will not listen to him. They should discipline him. Cursed is the man who dishonors his father and his mother." Proverbs puts it this way: if a man curses his father and his mother, his lamp should be snuffed out and placed in pitch darkness. The eye that mocks a father, that scorns obedience to a mother, will be pecked out by the ravens of the valley and will be eaten by vultures. Paul writes to the church in Galatia, and he says, "But if you're led by the Spirit, you're not of the law. But the acts of the sinful nature are obvious: sexual immorality, impurity, debauchery." And he moves on down that list. You'll notice this is one of the places where disobedience doesn't appear. But he says it's obvious. And I think it was obvious that disobedience was there in other lists, and it belongs there as well. But I just point out to you, it's not in every list. I just wanted you to see some of the other vice lists. Yes?
I'd like to echo that. I point out to my own children and honoring my parents, and they're setting a good example.
Right. So as we look at the text continues, it says, they are, remember, these words aren't there in the text. This is literally one long set of different things. We move them. The translators broke them up because now we're moving from a series of words that had been in the accusative case that were describing what people are to things that people aren't or without or things that they are missing. And so these steps up to it. It says, furthermore, I left my notes in my box. I'll keep talking. I think I left them in my box. If I didn't, we will make do. But
go check my box. I'll be there.
Anyway, they are senseless, faithless, heartless. There's a word that appears in the older translations and doesn't appear in the most modern, most recent discoveries. We'll talk a little bit about it so you're aware of it. And ruthless. These are four things that people are without, and we've been looking at it. And as we start to step through them, it says they are senseless. Interestingly enough, you get the idea so many different translations choose different words. This must be a Greek word where the meaning of the word isn't quite as definitive as envy was. Remember, every one of our translations chose envy. This is one where we see here, senseless is chosen by the NIV in the New English Translation. Without understanding is the context. Literally, it's this Greek word, asinos, ah meaning not, sonos means knowing, never not knowing, or not having sense, or senseless. So it's not that different when you move through, void of understanding,
foolishness, undiscerning, unintelligent. They refuse to understand. This is the phrase that gets used in Matthew and in Mark when it says, are you still dull? Remember when Jesus is speaking to the people, are you dull of hearing? Don't you understand? Is this not obvious to you? Do you not comprehend completely what's going on here? And see what God is doing there? These are people that lack sense. They lack common sense. They lack the ability to... Thank you. These are those, it denotes the people incapable of comprehending that which was spoken. People that are destitute of the capacity for spiritual things. The same word is the word we saw back in verse 21. We've actually seen this word before. There it said, for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God, nor they gave thanks to him. But in their thinking, they became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. The word foolish was how it was rendered back in verse 21. Here it's rendered senseless. It's this whole idea of being void of understanding of what was going on. The next one we see that they're void of is faithless.
Again, it's without or no faith. So you have faithless is the way the NIV chose to translate it. The American says it's untrustworthy. Because something that is trustworthy is faithful. And so they translated it untrustworthy. The older translations of the King James and the American Standard, as well as some of the two modern translations, the New English and the World English Bible, translated covenant breaker. Because the idea here that's being, it's not that you just lack faith, but you have a promise that you made and you don't keep your promises. Therefore, you're not a very faithful and trustworthy person. You are a covenant breaker. Those who break their promises, or a promise breaker. It's a word that's very much a pun to the previous word. When you look at here, these two words, senseless, again, it's this rhyming that goes through the text here. It's a very common word, actually, in Greek. And it is the word that is used in the Septuagint. Now remember, the Septuagint is the Old Testament that's been translated into Greek. And so when they translated it into Greek, I grabbed some passages. So I wanted you to see some of the Old Testament words that have been in Hebrew that get translated into English. The words that are bold are the words that is this exact same word. And it gets translated unfaithful. I sought after her when she had gone all that she would return to me, but she did not. And her unfaithful sister Judah saw it. I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and sent her away because of her adulteries. Now this word faithless is a different word. It's not the word that gets used there. Yet I saw her unfaithful sister. So the idea of not being one who kept the promises, not just one who lacks faith. That's what faithless up there, that Hebrew was the word here. In spite of her unfaithful sister. So the idea here, it's the idea of being unfaithful, not keeping your covenant, not keeping your promises, is the idea. The conjugate used in the form of a verb, it appears here. And he said, if I said, I will speak thus, I would have betrayed your children. I would have broken my covenant. I will not break my covenant. I will be a promise keeper. I will not be unfaithful like the fathers who were disloyal and faithless because they didn't keep their commitments is the idea that's going on in here. Psalm 119 says, I look on the faithless with loathing. That is, I look on those who don't keep their commitments is the context here. There's a commonality, if you see, between the idolatry. Those who promise to worship the true God, but go after and worship idols instead. They are not one who are keeping the covenant, keeping the relationship that's there. Sandy and Hedlund in their commentary says, they are men false to their engagement who treat it as nothing more than a scrap of paper.
It denotes being deceitful, unfaithful, false to your contract, people who cannot be trusted. It denotes people that could not be bound by an oath, because properly, how could you swear an oath in the name of God? I promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me be. They don't believe in God. They have no standards. How can you keep them and make them promise anything? As a covenant agreement is made in the presence of God, if you don't believe in God, how can you have a covenant? How can you have a relationship? How can you be bound by anything? This is what was going on in Rome at the time. The Roman citizens would love to have their government pass rules, because if they didn't like them, they just kill the guy that made up the rule. Another sport. Kill the rule maker. Those of us who went to Israel, remember we played the game Kill the King? You can be king for the day, because we're going to kill you at the end of the day. How wonderful to be king, because you're going to be banished. Because they play these ideas, because it was not unreasonable for a ruler or for a general, if you didn't agree with him, just kill him. You don't have to keep his promises. He made the commitment. He's dead. Long live the next king. We don't care what the other guy said. This is the context. And Paul writes to them and says, you are senseless. You are faithless. You don't keep your covenants. Not only that, you are heartless. You are without affection. Not affectionate. Heartless, unloving, without natural affection. Paul uses it, as he writes to Timothy, the same word saying it's translated in the NIV, is without love. It's a word that came up in Greek about the time when Paul was writing. You won't find it in the older manuscripts, but you'll find it in about the turn of the first century. It's a word that becomes new. It denoted the natural love relationship between a mother and her child. Is what this word strong is. So this is not being natural. Not having the natural bonding that should be there between a child and his mother. Not showing what is naturally loving. Well, not surprising. They've given up that which was natural for that which is unnatural. And we find that the heathens have no scruples. Psalm 106 puts it this way. They, meaning the Canaanites, sacrifice their sons and their daughters to demons. They shed innocent blood. The blood of their sons and their daughters who sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. And the land was desecrated by their blood. Well, that's just the pagans, Bert. Well, what about our friend Manasseh? King of Israel. He thought it was such a good idea, he sacrificed his sons in the valley of Ben Hinnom. And he practiced sorcery and divination and witchcraft and consulted the mediums and the spiritualists. He did much evil in the eyes of the Lord, provoking him to anger. He's a king of Israel. So it's not just the pagans, but we begin to understand these people that do things that aren't natural to them. Among the ancient Persians, it was a common custom to bury your children if they weren't perfect. Remember the story that a lot of it's playing on the television right now about the Spartans? When a child was born, if they were going to be the perfect warrior, you snuffed them out early. They didn't take the weaklings to war with you. Aristotle, in his work on government, enjoins the exposure of children and putting them out. Get rid of the feeble ones. We don't need them in our society. Interesting. When we consider what we may be practicing today. Yeah. The law of the 12 tables, which was enacted in the 301st year of Rome, said not taking care of your children was a barbarous practice. And yet the Romans violated it for over 700 years. Maxus Felix describes the barbarity of the Romans in this respect. He said, I see you exposing your infants to wild beasts and birds, or strangling them in the most miserable manner. Pliny the Elder defends the right of parents to destroy their children upon the ground by saying it was a necessary thing for population control. Tertullian, one of the early church fathers in his Apology, writes about the bold aspects of Romans during the time of Paul, and he says, how many of you, addressing themselves to the Roman people and the governors of the provinces, might I deservedly charge with infant murder? And not doing so, I would be guilty of all other kinds of death. For you choose the cruelest things to do to your children, such as drowning them, or starving them, or placing them in coal, or without or making them to draw hunger, or exposing them to the mercies of the dogs, drawing swords. Such things you do to your children. The Phoenicians and the Carthaginians sacrificed their children. People in China, the evidence is there in Peking, and some of the artifacts that we're digging up, over 9,000 children killed and offered in sacrifice as it goes on. So this, again, is not a Western. It's a depraved condition of mankind. We could talk about things going on in South Wales. We could talk about the Mexican altars of the infanticide that goes on there. You know, in the United States, not to pick on the rest of the world, you know the most likely day you are to die? Your birthday. Your birthday. Not your birthday, but the day of your birth is 10 times more probable to be the day you die. Here in the United States, according to our statistics, the Center for Disease Control, they make this statement, and this is reading from an article that was published 2 weeks ago in the paper. It says, even if I were to make it through the first day, you are still at risk of being murdered during your first year of life than any other time before you turn age 19. In their analysis, the CDC found that homicide of infants was the fifth leading cause of infant death in the United States. It's shocking that these crimes, so inherent to the feelings of humanity, are so common in our modern world, says the author as he writes in USA Today. These are but a spectrum of the views of the feelings of our heathen world, a painful narrative that will probably continue into our following centuries. Yeah.
After the birth of the child.
Yeah. The day of the birth is the most likely day, and the next most likely is the first year. They just kill them. They don't get the medical attention.
Intentionally,
you find like the lady gave birth at Walmart and threw her kid in the Dipsy dumpster. Remember? That was just in the news a couple weeks ago. Yeah. And so these are things that are being practiced in America today. Modern America. Yes, sir.
Well, does this also take into effect abortions?
No, because that's not it. I wasn't talking that. I was talking about actual after birth.
After birth.
Amazing. No, that may also do how well we treat people beyond that, then it's a higher probability if you're going to have an issue with it on the day. But nevertheless, the Center for Disease Control wrote this article and published a paper on it. And USA Today had this wonderful article describing the thing recently. The word that doesn't appear is the word implacable. It appears, like I said, in the Byzantine text, the text majority, and the Textus Receptus that the King James is based upon. It's a word that means unforgiving, truce breakers, without fidelity. It's just not in the most ancient manuscripts. So we're not going to spend any more time on it. And the last one, we'll close with the fourth one, the Ruth. It's ruthless, which I think is really interesting. Without mercy. You know, it starts off without justice and ends without mercy. If you look at the first one on the list, without justice, the last thing it ends at, without mercy. Ruthless, unmerciful. Unforgiving, ruthless people who delight in the cruelty and the exalting use of power to exploit others. As a proof of this, we just need to look at our own lives, read our society. We're a pretty unmerciful society. We're pretty ruthless ourselves. Pure religion opens up. You start looking at who built the hospitals? Christians. Who built the orphanages? Christians. Where Christ has been uplifted, social welfare and social reform has taken place. Where social welfare is tried, it's abysmally failed without religion, without the faith. Anyway, we will pick up this list as we continue on next Sunday. Let me pray. Father, I thank you for the time today. And I would just pray that you will take these lists of horrible things and teach us to be different people. We know these are things that characterize our very nature if we do not follow after you. So take away our natural nature and give us the nature of Christ. In his name we pray.
Amen.
Amen. Have a great week.